You know, news from around the world has been especially troubling lately. We've had a lot of things that are in the news that are quite concerning. Last week we had a notice. We were told about some problems in the potential civil war in Ivory Coast and the concerns that that poses for our members in that area. And certainly that's something I hope we'll continue to pray about. And then we had the earthquake of gigantic proportions hit Japan, about 80 miles offshore of Honshu, Japan's largest island. It's mainly a rural island, but it's still very heavily populated. And 8.9 magnitude quake is a huge thing. In fact, it destroyed buildings in Tokyo, 240 miles away. Think of that, 240 miles. Dallas is about what is Dallas, 100 or so, roughly, so twice that far, and another 40 miles on the other side. That's a long distance away to still destroy buildings. So other nations, the nation itself is still reeling from aftershocks. I heard there was one, somebody was telling me this morning, they heard about 6 on the Richter scale. That's pretty hefty earthquake all of its own, and that's just an aftershock. So certainly that's an area of concern. There are 2 nuclear plants that I read last night. Evacuations have been ordered around at least one of them because they fear that nuclear radioactive material has seeped out of the plant. There's another plant that is also having trouble with its cooling, can't cool down the radioactive material, so there are concerns about that plant also having some issues or some problems. In Luke chapter 21, of course, many of us recognize Luke 21 as a parallel to Matthew 24, the Sermon on the Mount. Luke 21 in verse 7, the disciples asked Jesus, saying, "Teacher, when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" And the answer begins in verse 8. Jesus' response was, "Take heed that you not be deceived." Now that's an interesting statement of its own, isn't it? To pause and reflect on, don't let yourself be deceived means that it's possible that you could be deceived about things. We could misunderstand, we could be misled. So he's saying, don't do that. I will give you information so that doesn't happen. "For many will come in my name saying, 'I am he,'" or "the one, and the time has drawn near." And how many times have you seen pictures of people walking around with the placards, you know, "The end is here, the end is here, the end is here, the end is near." He says, many are going to do that. "Therefore, don't go after them." Verse 9, but he says, "But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately." Jesus said wars and commotions are not the sign of the very end. Unfortunately, war has been going on basically since the beginning of humanity, hasn't it? Differing levels of intensity of wars in different geographical areas, but that's been going on, sadly, as a fact of human history, and we'll continue to hear about them. I got to wondering about this word commotions, though. It's interesting that Luke chose the word commotions, wars and commotions. I hadn't really focused on that word before. I knew it's a little bit different than what Matthew had recorded. Matthew said wars and rumors of wars. But I thought, what does commotion mean? What does that phrase mean? Thayer's Greek lexicon says disputes. What's the meaning of the Greek word that Luke used here for commotions? Well, Oneida, Greek English lexicon, emphasizes the aspect of mob action. Well, that's interesting. What's happened in the Middle East lately? It involves mobs. It involves groups of people that want to accomplish things, good or bad, but sort of being mobbed, or a mob action that's involved in this. Thayer's Greek lexicon translates it as instability, a state of disorder or disturbance, confusion. Think about what took place in Tunisia, what took place in Egypt, what's taking place in Libya and other areas in the Middle East right now. Those words seem to be pretty fitting. Theological Dictionary of New Testament says this word that is translated from the Greek as commotions here in the New King James in Luke 21 It says that means disorder. It means unrest. And it mentions both the personal unrest, that people themselves can be uneasy and not settled. They could be upset, unrest personally. And it also mentions political turmoil and says that often equates to revolution. Now think about that again in terms of what we've read recently in the Middle East. It certainly seems applicable, especially timely when we look what has happened in the recent weeks. The toppling of two governments, two leaders in Tunisia and Egypt, both toppled in that general area of the world. So I'd like to take a look today at some of the prophecies about that part of the world, the Middle East. It seems to be a timely topic to focus on. I don't often speak a whole sermon about prophecy. I give something basically every week with the prophetic times, sort of comments on that. But I thought today it might be good to address this. I thought the word commotions, as I thought about those different lexicons and the way they give the different nuances to that word, I thought it really fits with what we've seen in the Middle East and the Mediterranean area of the world today, with Tunisia being a little further west, North Africa. Seems to fit perfectly with the scuffle over a fruit stand. If you recall, if you've read the history of it, that's what got the whole thing started in Tunisia. It was a scuffle over a fruit stand. There was a young man, I think he was in his mid-20s, 26 or so. He's a fruit vendor. And an officer came along, it happened to be a lady, and she said he was operating that stand illegally, and she confiscated his fruit and his scale. Well, that was his livelihood. He was barely eking out a living, so he struggled to try to get it back, and in the process got slapped by her and beaten by a couple of her companions. He went to the police station to demand his property back and got another beating from the police for having the lack of wisdom, I guess, of going to ask for it. Wouldn't you ask for your stuff back? I mean, but because he did, they beat him again. And he thought, well, I'll go to the governor's office to plead his case, but still no results. So in a fit of despair, the man soaked himself in paint thinner and set himself on fire. I mean, talk about desperation, because he had lost his means of support in his livelihood for him and anyone else that may have been depending on him. The unrest in the area of the Middle East and that part of the world seems to focus on several things. Corrupt government is certainly a part of it. Many people are frustrated with the oppressive and corrupt governments they see in their countries. That often leads to problems, often leads to economic problems, high unemployment, people who barely struggle or extremely poor and not gainfully employed and struggling to just barely survive, as that fruit vendor was in Tunisia. And of course, the prospects are of rising prices in many of those areas as well, and people who are already barely making it, barely surviving, when prices start going up because the price of oil goes up, therefore the price of everything that's transported goes up, it's again a very discouraging thing for people. And this turmoil is in many parts of the world. It's especially volatile, it seems, in the Middle East right now. So I'd like to take some time today to talk about the Middle East and prophecy, as I've titled this sermon. Now, there's a common root for most of the wars and fightings in the Middle East today. Some time back, a number of years ago now, I gave a sermon on a family divided, explained how the family of Abraham sowed the seeds of a lot of modern conflicts. Probably all forgotten that one, but you know the basic story of it, that Abraham's family is deeply involved in that. The point is this, the family of Abraham is where much of the strife in the Middle East now finds its roots. That's where it came from. In a sense, you can see that in just the fact that there are three of the world's great religions that are centered in the Middle East, find their roots in the Middle East. Of course, Christianity is there, Judaism before that, and Islam, all three of them trace their roots back to Abraham. Let's go to Genesis 12. We'll just do a real quick look at a few of those points of history that point to why we see what we do in the Middle East today. In Genesis chapter 12, in verse 1, we find the account the history of God speaking to Abraham, telling him to get out of his country, to leave, go from your father's house, he says, to a land that I will show you at the end of verse 1. And verse 2 says, I will make you a great nation, I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. So here is a prophecy God is giving to Abraham. Here's what's going to happen. You follow me, you do what I ask. In a sense, do your duty. This is your duty. I'm giving you something to do. Do it. Be faithful to it. And here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you a blessing to the world. I'll make your name great. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless those, verse 3, who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, we realize there's a spiritual component of that. Abraham is called the father of the faithful. There are many other physical, spiritual parallels that we could discuss in terms of this. I'm looking today mainly at the physical aspect of it, or the physical component. Verse 4, it says, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. And so they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah. And the Canaanites were then in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, or Abram, as his name was then, Abram, he said, to your descendants I will give this land. Well, Abram didn't have any descendants yet. So there was a promise implied in that he would have descendants. To your descendants, to your offspring, I'll give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. God promised the land of Canaan to Abram and to his descendants. He said, I'll give it to them. They're the ones who are going to own this property, this piece of the planet Earth. Now, go over a few chapters. This was when he was 75, over in chapter 15. Again, we'll just read a few verses at the start. It says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, Abram. I'm your shield, your exceedingly great reward. But Abram said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. It seems as though Abram, I mean, we're reading between the lines here, but judging by what he's saying, Abram's getting a little discouraged. Here, we've gone all these years. You said I would have offspring. You said I would have descendants. I have to have descendants to take possession of the land. And God, as it looks right now, it's going to be this foreigner, this individual who's not even my own literal son, who's going to inherit everything. And behold, verse 4, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Don't worry, Abraham, or Abram. Don't worry. I will fulfill my duty. Talk about somebody who fulfills duty. God does. Now, not always on our time frame. We would like it now. Sometimes he says, wait. But he says, I'll do it. I'll do my duty. I will make sure you have an heir who will come from your own body. And he brought him outside and said, look now toward heaven and count the stars if you're able to number them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed in the Lord, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Abraham seems to have been losing heart, but God promised, you will have descendants from your own loins, from your own body. You're going to have children. They're going to be the ones who take possession of this land. He promised that. Down in verse 18, notice what he says. On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the land of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, what is that? What does that look like? I thought it might be good to put this on a map. Now, this is a map from Thomas Nelson, Inc. It's copyrighted by them, so copyright information's at the top here. But you'll note this sort of picture of the Middle East. These are the nations from Genesis chapter 10, prior to this. But it shows you the general area. If you know where the Euphrates River is, let me just put a little note there, a little circle to show you the Euphrates River running through the Middle East and the River of Egypt, certainly the Nile River, down on the bottom left part of that. So all of the area between those two rivers, he said, this is what I'm giving you. This is what I'm giving your descendants. That's a pretty nice little piece of real estate. The King Ranch in South Texas is a massive ranch. I forgot how many acres that is, but somebody remember, is it 10,000 or something acres? I don't know. It's huge, I guess, but that's tiny compared to this piece of real estate. God says everything between the Nile River and the Euphrates, that whole area in there of Canaan, it was where the Canaanites were in Canaan, and everything between those rivers, that's what I'm going to give to your descendants. Now that's, again, that's huge. Now, let's take a look at what that is in terms of modern nations. Let me just give you another map that shows you sort of within the last 10, 15 years or so at least, what that part of the of the world looks like. Let me throw in some rough squiggles that approximate the... I see it shifted on me. Just imagine in your minds up about a quarter inch for each of those. The Nile River really does dump into the Mediterranean Sea, but that's a rough approximation of where those two rivers are. Everything in that area is what God said He was going to give to Abram and to his children. And yet look at the size of the nation of Israel, the modern nation of Israel, the little dark green area in there. It's tiny compared to the rest of that. Think about this, though. How big was Abraham's family? Was it only Judah? Was it only the 12 tribes of Israel? No, it wasn't, was it? The interesting thing is God fulfilled His promise. I won't say surprising. It's not surprising at all. God fulfilled what He told Abram He was going to do in giving His descendants that area of the world. In Genesis chapter 16, it says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar, and you know the rest of the story there, don't you? Look, God hasn't given us any children. Why don't you take Hagar? You have children by her. We'll call that child our child. It'll be through you, but this is a surrogate, I guess, in a sense. It'll be through Hagar, but it'll be our child. And Abram listened to Sarai. And he went in, verse 4 says, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Enter another woman into the family relationship, and guess what you get? That's not a good picture, is it? You get conflict. You get tension. You get enmity between the two women in the house. And it got so bad that eventually Hagar ran off. In verse 5 and 6, you read that. Abram told Sarai, do what you want. She's your maid. And she dealt harshly with her, and Hagar fled. And of course, God intervened and made some promises to Hagar in terms of her son, Ishmael. Skip down to verse 9. We'll just pick it up here. It says, the angel of the Lord said to her, when he had talked with her, met her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude. Sort of the same thing he said to Abram, wasn't it? Through you, Hagar, your descendants are going to be like the sand of the sea, like the stars of the heaven, unable to be counted. There are going to be so many of them. They're going to be exceedingly great. The angel of the Lord said to her in verse 11, behold, you're with child, you will bear a son, and you'll call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. Now, the rest of the prophecy is not quite as positive, is it? Because he says in verse 12, he will be a wild man. Actually, some translations say, some of the Hebrew lexicons say that literally means a wild donkey of a man. Or the less polite term, of a man. That's what he's going to be like. And the hand of everyone will be against him, or his hand rather will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he'll dwell in the presence of all his brethren. That phrase is also in Hebrew a little awkward. Some translations or some lexicon say it literally means dwelling on the outskirts of people. In other words, out on the edge of the wilderness or in the wilderness. That's going to be his primary domain. That's where he's going to be. And the last verse of this chapter, chapter 16, tells us Abram was 86 years old when Ishmael, his first child, was born. So Ishmael is a progenitor of many of the nation's Arabs, many of those states that are Arab nations today. And Muhammad, the founder of Islam, was a descendant of Ishmael. And his hand being against everyone and everyone's hand being against him indicated there would be disputes, even among themselves. Their brothers, their fellow family members, but they're going to squabble among themselves. They're going to be at each other. Disputes would continue between Abraham's descendants themselves and between Abraham and the other descendants, or of Ishmael and the other descendants of Abraham. And that certainly has been the case as well. There's been a lot of conflict. In fact, let me put that back up. How much conflict has there been in that area of the world? And if you look historically, there's been a tremendous amount of conflict. Now, of course, there's also a tremendous amount of wealth there, isn't there? With the invention of the internal combustion engine and the realization that petroleum is an important part of driving the engines of the world, this piece of sandy real estate has become extremely important to the whole world's economy. And chapter 21, of course, 14 years after Ishmael was born, we find that God does follow through on his promise. As I said, it's not always in the time we want, but God is faithful to his duty and his promises. Verse 1 of chapter 21, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time set of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, who Sarah bore him, Isaac. Again, it's not through Hagar. This is the son born to Abraham through Sarai, or through Sarah. And he called him Isaac. That was his name. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as the Lord commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. So Ishmael was a teenager at that time, and suddenly there's a new baby in the family. And in fact, it's a baby born directly to Abraham and Sarah, not through Hagar. Now, I think human nature probably was pretty similar back then as it is today. And guess what? There wasn't a lot of love between the brothers. Just didn't work that way. The child grew, verse 8 mentions, and as he grew, he was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. This was a happy time. My son, through my wife, God has followed through on his promise. What a miraculous thing, as old as we are, and yet he's blessed us with a child, just as he said was going to happen. And verse 9, and Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian woman whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Ishmael was scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. So the strife continued. In fact, to the point of Hagar and Ishmael being kicked out of the family. The matter was displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son, but God said, don't let it be displeasing because of the bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said, you listen to her voice. For in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed. This whole area of the world is going to be yours through your seed, through two different women. Now, eventually, we read in chapter 25, describes other sons. When Sarah died, Abraham took another wife, Keturah. I won't read through all the names, but chapter 25 describes some of those sons, tells us that Isaac also had twin boys, Esau and Jacob. And chapter 25, let's read a little bit about Esau and Jacob. Verse 27, now we're looking within the family of Isaac, that line through which God said, this is where the blessing that I have in mind for a particular nation is going to go. Now, through Ishmael, this other line, they're going to grow too. They're going to be huge. They're going to be many people. They're going to inherit a lot of land. But the one that I'm specifically dealing with is going to come through Isaac, the child or the son of blessing. And verse 27, so the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Interesting how you can even have twins. Not just born within the same family, but twins. Who are night and day, personality-wise. One enjoyed the outdoors, one loved hunting, one was a rugged individual, the other was a more mild individual who stayed at home. Mild man, dwelling in the tents, dwelling in the dwelling places. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. That's a manly man, right? Bring home those fish. Bring home the game. Give me the wild stuff. I love it. And he was drawn to his son, Esau. But Rebekah loved Jacob. I would imagine Jacob was much better at taking care of the honeydew list around the tents. You know, if we could just move this tent here and we could lift that flap just a little there to give a little shade in the afternoon, if we put it at this angle, I bet she had a nice long list of honeydews for him. And apparently he did enough around the place, around the tents, around the dwellings, that Rebekah had a lot of respect for. Or maybe he cooked. We know he was a good cook. Maybe he was an excellent chef and really thorough some of the cookings. I don't know. I'm speculating, just kind of guessing. But whatever it was, something about him being around the dwelling places drew Rebekah to him. So here you have, within the same family, twin boys, very different personalities. And you see that within that family, even though they're very different, you have favoritism being shown by the parents. And it obviously became apparent to the boys as well. And Jacob cooked a stew. You know the story here too. Esau came in from the field. He was weary. Esau said to Jacob, feed me with some of the red stew, for I'm weary. And therefore he was called Edom. But Jacob said, which means red. And down in verse 21, but Jacob said, sell me your birthright right as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. So what's this birthright to me? Didn't think very far in the future, did he? Rather short attention span and short-sighted. What's this worth to me? And so Jacob said, well, swear to me that you'll do it. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, which he ate and drank, and he rose and went his way. And thus Esau despised his birthright. So we have a further deterioration between the two boys and their relationship. How the family dynamics deteriorate even more. Not only do we have Ishmael's descendants at odds with Isaac's descendants, but now we have twin brothers, the sons of Isaac, at odds with each other. Chapter 27, verse 14. You remember the story. Actually, I won't read the whole story here. Just you remember the story how the blessing was also by deceit was given to Jacob. And Esau, who was Edom, hated Jacob because of that. In fact, down in verse 41, that's the verse I was going to read, says, so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. When dad dies, so does Jacob. That's it. Tired of all of this mess. Now Esau's descendants intermarried with Ishmael's descendants. And as expected, they continue to hold hard feelings against Jacob's descendants. The bitterness, the hatred intensified through the centuries. Again, these are all the dynamics of the Middle East. All within a family. It's amazing. Bitterness and hatred has been gone on for centuries. Let's add one more item. Genesis chapter 36. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 36. And notice the genealogy of Esau. And skip down to verse 12. You might remember that there was some issue with a nation called the Amalekites, or with Amalek. Down in verse 12 it says, "Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Adah, Esau's wife." So Esau's grandson was Amalek, the father of the Amalekites. You might remember they fought with the descendants of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. They came out to fight against Israel when they were fleeing from Egypt. They'd just been freed from slavery. Now, how's that for a relative? How's that for treatment from a relative? We just got out of slavery. God miraculously brought us out here. We're wandering in the wilderness. You read the story, and they were hungry. They were thirsty. God miraculously gave them water. And the next thing we're told is here their distant relatives come to fight against them, come to destroy them. And they're out in the middle of nowhere, struggling to survive. And here come the relatives. "Oh, great, we'll get help." No, you get a sword's what you get. You get a sword. What a horrible family dynamic. Exodus chapter 17, just turn real quickly there. Exodus 17 is where you find that recorded. In verse 6, talks about that Moses striking the rock to bring water out so the people can drink. And down in verse 8 says, "Now Amalek came and fought against Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us men and go out and fight against him. Tomorrow I'll stand at the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' And Joshua did as Moses said to him, and he fought with Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. And when Moses held his arms up," you remember that at that time, children of Israel were prevailing. And when Moses' arms got tired and he brought them down, then the Amalekites started winning. The battle swayed and went the other direction. So Aaron and Hur propped his arms up, supported them, one on one side, one on the other. Verse 12 says, "They did that till the going down of the sun." And don't you know, they were both sore. All three of them had to be very sore the next day. I enjoyed fishing with my brother three times. And the net's heavy. He had the fishing license, so he did all the throwing, but even carrying fish, you know, you're carrying fish in buckets, 25 of them, that gets a little tiring the next day. I'm like, "Oh, my arms, you know, I'm not used to carrying that much, you know, hundreds and hundreds of yards up and down the bank." Imagine these guys who stood there all day holding up his arms. They had to be extremely sore the next day. So Joseph defeated Amalek, verse 13, "and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of the Amalek from under the heavens.' And Moses built an altar." And verse 16, he says, "For he said, 'Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" This is going to be an ongoing issue. Amalek, the Amalekites, are going to fight with the descendants of Israel, the descendants of Isaac, the descendants of Abraham on that side. Again, you've got strife between Isaac and Ishmael's descendants. And he said it's going to go on generation after generation after generation. Now, some scholars believe the modern Palestinians are the descendants of the Amalekites. Been a lot of turmoil, a lot of fighting between Palestinians and the tribe of Judah. This means there would be a historical reason why the Arabs and the Palestinians hate the Jews, who are the descendants of Jacob. Again, talk about a terrible family feud. Now, let's talk for a little bit historically in terms of the fact of the two nations. Jacob's name was eventually changed to Israel. He had 12 sons, went into captivity in Egypt. God brought them out of captivity. But they only controlled a small area of that land between the rivers. Notice this on the map of the kingdom years. This is the area that they had control of. That's just a tiny little sliver. Again, remember the size of the nation of Israel in that other bigger map that showed that area between the two rivers? God truly did bless Israel in the time of David and Solomon, but they only had a small portion of that land, that Middle East area that they controlled. Even in the days of Solomon, which is the lighter reddish shading going all the way up past the area of Zobah, up in Riblah. That's another Thomas Nelson map. But even on the furthest extent is only a tiny little piece of all of that land that is actually controlled by the descendants of Israel or the descendants of Jacob. Eventually, they broke into two nations and went into captivity. You know the history there. Israel was scattered through the rest of lots of different places after their captivity. But Judah returned to Jerusalem after 70 years, and Judah set up a nation again. And that was the nation that eventually God sent Jesus Christ to. And in AD 70, Jerusalem was destroyed, and the Jews were again without a homeland. They were wiped out, even of this tiny piece of real estate, and no longer had any control over any of that area between the two rivers. And until the early 600s, the Arabs and the Palestinians remained somewhat obscure in the Middle East. It wasn't a whole lot that they were doing. They were nomadic, wild people, as God had said Ishmael's descendants would be. But eventually, Muhammad, the great prophet of Islam, is said to have received a vision in the early 600s. From the archangel. He claims it was from the archangel Gabriel. There's some wild stories about his visions and things that were involved in that. But one thing he did do is that he told the people that they should follow one God, not many gods. Of course, he called him Allah, and said, this is the one God you should worship, not lots of gods. And many of his writings, and many of the visions from Muhammad, form the basis of the Quran, the holy book of Islam. And largely due to Muhammad's preaching, the Arab peoples have found unity in their religious beliefs. He was able to impose his views and his teachings on much of the rest of the Arabic world. Advocates of Islam now are found throughout the world. In fact, it's the second largest religion of the world, 1.5 billion followers, based on the information from adherence.com that I looked at just recently. And it's one of the fastest growing religions in the world. Why? Well, there are perhaps a number of issues. One is birth rates, another is proselyting. They do a good job of that. They're very strong in their proselyting efforts. There are 22 Arab nations hold the majority of the world's known oil reserves. As I said, that's become a very important part of our world economy. So, from basically the 600s to World War I, the Middle East was largely controlled by the Arab peacefuls, and then by the Turks and the Ottoman Empire. What's interesting is to look at their view, Islam's view, of the world. From their perspective, Ishmael is the son of Abraham. Abraham was promised great blessings. So, if you descend from that side of the family tree, what is the natural way for you to interpret prophecies? They're for us. Not the other side of the family tree that went through Isaac. It's amazing, you can see the same historical thing and have people who have totally different interpretations of it. That's Islam's interpretation. We are the chosen people. Islam is the chosen religion worshiping the true God. Not Israel, not Judah. Of course, that brings us to the modern nation of Israel. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1917, Britain was in control of the area and Jews began moving there. Arabs saw that as a threat. Wait a minute, we got them out of here before. Now they're starting to move back, and they fought, tried to keep them out. Eventually, Britain backed out of it, turned it over to the United Nations, and in 1947, the UN partitioned the land into an Arab state and a Jewish state. The Jews, of course, accepted it. Sure, we'll take property, we'll take a place to live, a homeland, we'll take a nation. The Arabs said, we reject it, we don't accept it. But the UN forced it anyway and called for Jerusalem to be an international city run by the UN. And the state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, came into being in May of 1947. So now there is a little bit of this piece of territory that is again in the hands of the descendants of Isaac. And of course, immediately after it was formed, it was attacked by surrounding Arab nations, but Israel survived. And they survived subsequent wars as well. But the animosity continues. Arab hostility toward the state of Israel has not been resolved. And since the U.S. supports Israel, there is a lot of animosity toward the U.S. as well from the Arab world. And it's fueled additionally by the fact they see us as an immoral nation. They're not wrong in that. We are, as a whole, an immoral nation, exporting a lot of immorality to the rest of the world. And as they see it, perverting and trying to cause Muslims throughout the world to become immoral as well. And so they hate us for that reason. And they see us as someone, as a nation, as a group of people that needs to be defeated, conquered, destroyed. As they do for the modern nation of Israel. So that brings us up to where we are in history and why there is so much turmoil. Let's go to the book of Daniel now and look at a couple of things about some more modern prophecies. Those prophecies that God made to Abraham or Abram, that I will bless you, that your descendants will control this area from the Nile River to the Euphrates, came to pass. They didn't all come to pass in the descendants of Isaac and eventually of Israel, but they did come to pass through both Isaac and Ishmael, that they control those areas or that area of the world. Now, God used Daniel during the time of Cyrus, king of Persia, to record some prophecies. This was back several hundred years before Christ appeared. So this is back in the time of B.C. It was after Judah had come back out of captivity, and then once, or when they had gone again into captivity. Daniel chapter 10, let's pick it up there. It says, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message, and he understood the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, no meat nor wine came to my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. David was very sincere in seeking help from God and understanding some things. And in the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz. And his body was like beryl. He describes what this individual looked like, this obviously an angel. In verse 7, he says, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great terror fell on them, so they fled to hide themselves. And therefore I was left alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me, for my vigor was returned to frailty in me, and I retained no strength. This angel appeared to Daniel, and he was there to give him a glimpse of what was going to go on in the times to come, and also to tell him a little bit of what goes on in that invisible realm, invisible to us, invisible to human eyes. So he describes down in verse 11, he says, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words I speak to you. Stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And while he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. And he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I've come because of your words. God listened. God heard from the very first day. It wasn't that God didn't hear you, Daniel. I'm come because of what you were saying and what you were asking. But he said, verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. So there are workings in the angelic realm that this angel, the prince of the kingdom of Persia, withstood him, wouldn't let him come to Daniel. And finally, he got help from Michael, one of the archangels. And he was able to come to Daniel to explain, to tell him what he had to say. In verse 14, now I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, to the nation of Israel, reestablished. It'll be reestablished. There'll be lots of things that happen in the back and forth. till it comes to the point of the latter days. What will happen to your people in the latter days? For the vision refers to many days yet to come. And of course, chapter 11 is what he gave him. The history or the prophecies in chapter 11 describe a lot of events that took place in the Middle East between the time of Daniel and the kingdom of Persia and the end time. I've gone through this prophecy several times, and every time I do, I'm amazed at all the things, all the little details that were fulfilled in that prophecy. Up until the time of basically Antiochus Epiphanes and the struggles the Jews had with him about 150 years before Jesus Christ came in the flesh. But in verse 39, as you read through that, it seems that everything just seems to stop. And there's a long pause until you come to verse 40, the events of verse 40. It seems to jump ahead, Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. It jumps ahead to the time of the end. And verse 40 says, "At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him." Now, in the intervening verses, up to that point, it describes the king of the south and the king of the north, and it's Syria is typically the king of the north. And the king of the south involves Egypt and others that are perhaps in league with Egypt. And now, suddenly, again, there is a king of the south and a king of the north. And the king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he'll enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Now, we read that verse, and since AD 70 to 1947, there was no nation of Israel. It didn't exist. So, the things that we read in verse 41 about going through the glorious land, entering into the glorious land, it wouldn't have made sense if there was no nation there that was a descendant of Isaac. 1947, it became possible that there was, again, a nation. In fact, there was one again on the scene to bring some relevance to this passage, especially the wording about the end time. There's again a physical nation descended from Judah who, from a northern and a southern perspective, you can have kings of the north, kings of the south. Individuals, leagues of nations, perhaps, that would be attacking. Again, prior to this, the king of the north was Syria and later the Roman Empire. The king of the south, basically, the king of the north, I mean, was Syria and the Roman Empire later. And the king of the south, typically, was Egypt. Those in that area. Who are those kings now? That's been a question we've speculated on over the years, isn't it? We've looked at different things. Daniel 2 speaks about an image picturing four world-ruling empires. Again, I'm covering a lot of material prophetically, but I think most of us are probably familiar with that. In Daniel chapter 2, you had the image with a head of gold and a chest of silver and then bronze or brass, and then you had iron, legs of iron. Spoke about four successive world-ruling empires. The Chaldean, or the Babylonian, and the Persian, the Greek, and then the Roman Empire. And it talks about a final group down to the very bottom of that statue, 10 toes. And in the time of those kings, this stone cut out without hands smashes the image on its feet. That's the return of Jesus Christ. All the way down to the very time of the end. Daniel chapter 7 describes four beasts, and the fourth beast has 10 horns. Successive kingdoms of that fourth kingdom or fourth world ruling dominant force. Revelation chapter 13 describes a terrible beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. Again, seem to correlate with this fourth beast and with that fourth kingdom, fourth world ruling empire of Daniel 2. And the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7 with the 10 horns. So putting those together, it appears that there is going to be another revival of the Roman Empire. A northern kingdom, north from where the descendants of Isaac, the descendants of Israel are. It will be a revival of that kingdom to be the king of the north. That we've felt relatively sure about for years. And the king of the south, we've had a little shift in thinking recently, haven't we? As we've looked at the way things have come together in the Middle East. and you look at the Arab worlds. We'd long thought that perhaps the other world ruling power many years ago was Russia. China, we certainly understood, had great potential, and now they have risen to be a more dominant world power. Basically own us. They call the debt due any minute, and we can't repay it. Basically, they own us. We've often thought, well, maybe that's the king of the south. Maybe that's a part of it. But in more recent years, it appears quite possible that a unified group of Arab nations, who in the past had been all fighting among themselves, but now who have been coming more and more together under the banner of Islam, perhaps they could be that powerful king of the south. That's what makes the situation in Egypt of the last few weeks so interesting. Because now, Egypt, who had stood out from the rest of the Arab world by recognizing the right of Israel to exist, now that government no longer exists. It's been overthrown. In a matter of a week, it was overthrown. What an incredibly fast-moving event on the world geopolitical scene. Now Egypt's undergone this overthrow of a ruling president and establishment of a new government. Is it going to be an Islamic government? Well, already you see reports about clashes between Christians and Muslims in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood is expected to play a growing role in that new Egyptian government and to try to steer it toward Islamic law as being the law of the land. That would put Egypt right in line with many of the other Arab nations in that area. Will there be an Islamic group that is that king of the south? Maybe even join with China. Again, we're speculating. I don't know. But if China and Russia got involved in that as well, it could be an incredibly powerful group. Could be even without Russia and China. Maybe Russia and China are something else that comes up when we see down in verse 44, news from the east and news from the north. Trouble that king of the north causes him to go back. Maybe that's another world power that comes into play. The world's waited. It is over 1,850 years that the world waited for the end of the physical nation of Jewish state in AD 70 until a new one came into being in 1947. Now we see things changing, happening pretty quickly in the Middle East. Are we now seeing the forming of another Islamic powerhouse that will become that king of the south? It's quite possible. Very possible. The Muslim Brotherhood, maybe you've read a little bit about them, like many other groups in Islam, are anxious to form another caliphate. That's just an area where a physical descendant of Muhammad, becomes both the physical and spiritual leader. And ushers in what they consider to be this new era of a powerful political military group of Arabs, unified in their hatred of their distant relatives. So, interesting to go through that. Before we continue here in Daniel 11, hold your place there. I want to go back and read a couple of other verses. Again, these are things we're familiar with, but just to remind us, in Zechariah chapter 12, notice what God says about Jerusalem. Since 1917 and 1948, ever since that period, it has been very obvious that Jerusalem has been at the center of quite a bit of controversy in our modern world. In Zechariah chapter 12, verse 1, the burden of the Lord of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples, when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. It's going to impact everybody at some point or another. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. God says it's going to be a thorn in the side, a pain in the whatever, for lots and lots of people. And Israel, the modern nation of Israel and the city of Jerusalem, has been just that. Remains a quandary, remains a burden for the United States and anyone else who wants to help them. And it often garners the hatred of Arab nations because people are trying to help Israel. Zechariah chapter 14. We turn over here, we look at the end of end time, all right, at the return of Jesus Christ. Verse 1 sets the timing, says the day of the Lord is coming. It's one of the phrases that's used over and over again prophetically for meaning the return of Jesus Christ or the things leading up to the return of Jesus Christ, those end time events. The day of the Lord is coming and your spoil will be divided in your midst. I'll gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city will go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as He fights in the day of battle. And in that day His feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two, from east to west, making a very large valley. Half the mountain shall be moved toward the north, half toward the south. The time of Christ's return, He says, the nations are going to be gathered to fight against Jerusalem. And God's going to go out and fight against the nations of the world. We find the same thing mentioned in the book of Revelation, that that's going to happen. But let's go back to Daniel chapter 11. They're going to fight against Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's going to be in the thick of things all the way up to the return of Jesus Christ. Daniel chapter 11, let's go back to verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him. The king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he'll enter the countries, overwhelm, and pass through. He'll overwhelm and he'll pass through them. And he'll enter the glorious land. And again, that's speaking of the modern nation of Israel, the descendants of Isaac, the descendants of one tribe of Israel, of Judah. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, who are those? Do you remember the previous map? Let me go back to this previous map that showed the nation of Israel during the kingdom years. Notice on the map where those nations or where those peoples are located. Let me give you some highlights here for Edom, for Moab, and for Ammon. They're right around the area that Israel had control of. Those three, he says, they're going to escape out of his hand of the king of the north. He'll stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. That indicates that Egypt is not on the side of the king of the north, doesn't it? That Egypt is probably with the king of the south or a part of the king of the south's power. He'll stretch out his hand against the countries. The land of Egypt shall not escape. He'll have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Now, is that news from China and Russia? Maybe so. Perhaps that's the news that troubles him. Therefore, he'll go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he'll plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. It makes it very clear that when he talks about the glorious land, he's talking about Jerusalem. He's talking about the mountain of God. Yet he should come to his end and no one will help him. Now, again, ultimately, God, when he brings all nations against Jerusalem, God's going to destroy those nations. The book of Revelation describes warfare that eventually destroys a third of mankind. That's in the sixth trumpet, right before the final trumpet. And like Zechariah, Revelation describes all nations coming to fight in the area of Israel, this area of the world in the Middle East. Let's go to Revelation chapter 16. There are a couple of references to this. Let's just read several verses here in Revelation chapter 16. Let's begin in verse 12. It says, "The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up so that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." And he says, "I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world." Excuse me, "and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon." This is that battle of Armageddon, or Armageddon, at the Valley of Megiddo, just north of Jerusalem. All nations come to that Valley of Megiddo where they fight against Jesus Christ. Now, apparently, they're going to think they're fighting against the Antichrist, false prophet. And the beast power will have convinced them of that, it seems. And so they'll fight against Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ is not going to be overthrown. He will destroy them. Now, the interesting point to me in this is, what do we do with this information? I mean, this is historical, this is prophetic that has been fulfilled, prophetic that is yet to be fulfilled. What do we do with all of that? Well, we just read what we do, don't we? Didn't we? A verse kind of interspersed, just thrown in here, suddenly says, "Behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches." What are we supposed to do? If we want to be blessed, we're supposed to watch. But it's not just a matter of academics. It's not just a matter of saying, I can put this pin on the map here and that pin over here, and I can watch what this nation's doing and watch what that nation's doing and go about my life just doing whatever I want to do. There's more to it than just watching. "Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." Now, garments in the book of Revelation are described as white linen, being the righteousness of saints. Right living, righteous living, living what we know, living what we believe. Not just head knowledge, not just saying, "Hey, I got all this wisdom, I got all this information, I can tell you this and that, and I can tell you all kinds of prophecies and who this person is and who that nation is. I can tell you how it's all going to play out. I got it all figured out in my head." It's not all there is to it. It says watch. Yes, we need to watch. We need to be alert to see what's happening. But along with that, you also have to keep your garments. You've got to keep your walk being the right type of righteousness, remaining faithful to God, the right kind of walk. Let's go back to Luke 21 where we started. And we'll see that emphasized here as well. As we look at what God tells us to do about prophetic information, about what we know about the Middle East and the prophecies of the Middle East and what's going to happen as we get near the end time, chapter 21 of the book of Luke talks about what's going to happen at the end time. And notice the warning Jesus gave us. He gave the disciples, and he gives it through them, being recorded by Luke. He gives it to us as well in verse 34. He tells them in verse 33, "Heaven and earth could pass away, but what I've told you won't. This is more sure even than the terra firma, what you're standing on. Because this is the word of God, and God will see that his word is done. His will is done." Verse 34, "But take heed to yourselves." Again, the emphasis in this passage is not just to watch world events. I mean, that's part of it. Watch, be aware of what's happening. But it's not just watching world events. Take heed to yourselves. Watch yourselves. And this is especially poignant as we come toward the time of Passover, isn't it? It's a time when we emphasize that anyway. But watch yourselves. This is not just Passover. This is all the time. As Christians, we need to watch ourselves. Take heed, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. So while it is interesting to look at prophecies, while it's interesting to look at the Middle East, it's interesting to see how all of this fits together, to see how God fulfilled His promises to Abraham through both lines of His descendants, through Ishmael and through Isaac. And it's interesting to me, at least, to see how that conflict between those family members has continued over the centuries and is going to escalate in the time of the end, even. It's going to continue to be there. But the important thing is not just understanding that. As Jesus Christ Himself said, the important thing is to make sure we're watching and keeping our garments white, not just before Passover. It's important then, but throughout the whole year, throughout our whole lives, every day, it's important to watch, pray, and remain faithful and clothed in right behavior so we can be deemed worthy. God's the only one that can deem us worthy. We never earned that. But God can deem us worthy. If we do our part, He'll do His. If we do our duty, as we heard in the sermonette, He'll do His. Worthy, deemed by Him, worthy of His protection, worthy of the right to stand confidently in Christ's presence.